Hello, this is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Anatoly Karlin. Anatoly, it's great having you on.
Thank you.
So, first of all, tell us a little bit about yourself. You're a blogger, a businessman. You're originally from Russia, and you focus on a lot of issues dealing with Russia. You also studied at UC Berkeley, and you live in the SF Bay Area.
That is a good 101 on me, on my bio. Yes, indeed. That basically describes me. I moved to the United States a few years ago. I'm originally from Russia. I now blog for the UNZ Review. That's Ron UNZ, so that's UNZ.com. And I have a blog there, and most of my blogging is about Russian politics, geopolitics, international affairs, HBD, i.e. human biodiversity, psychometrics, that is IQ, and in particular I'm interested in how IQ influences economic growth. That's what those are the main topics that I blog about.
So you say you're hesitant about attaching labels to yourself, but if it's really necessary, you suppose liberal, conservative, neo-reactionary would be close enough?
Very loosely. So basically, when I say, when I talk of liberal conservatism, I am basically talking about the 19th century Russian ideology, which was pretty much an antecedent to reaction developed in books such as Vehi and by people such as Ivan Ilyin.
So with ideology, I guess we were going to discuss these different concepts. So I sent you those things. Well, you had some commentary on the concept of the alternative left, and mm-hmm. that was an idea from Robert Lindsay.
Mm-hmm.
And I also sent you that article on the radical center, which is from an article by Barrier Guy, but I have an upcoming show on that topic.
Mm-hmm.
And you're also kind of affiliated with like the neo-reactionary movement as well. Could you sort of comment on these different concepts?
Oh, okay, certainly, and how they all tie together. Okay, well, firstly, I think that neo-reaction has a lot of good things going for it. So it's basically drawing upon old wisdoms that are getting gradually forgotten in the hype over democracy and liberalism and the end of history. And it's really good that they're reaching back into history for alternative ideas. Of course, I don't actually move in reactionary circle, in neo-reactionary circles as such, and as such I wouldn't even describe myself as neo-reactionary, especially because they have very firm ideas against the so-called entryism. They don't like entryists, and so I don't want to disappoint them, to go against them that way. So I wouldn't describe myself as a neo-reactionary. I do, however, think they have a lot of very good ideas. Of course, they also have their blind spots, like any other ideology. For instance, many of them basically seem to be disillusioned libertarians. So Moldberg was a libertarian before he became a neo-reactionary. And basically they were libertarians who realized that the average person is pretty dumb and wouldn't be able to uphold their libertarian utopia. So basically all those pills will have to be kept down while those neo-reactionary overlords rule over them. That's sort of a caricature, but I don't think it's totally a totally false one, however.
Well, they're individualistic, but they realize the problem that with libertarianism is they weren't going to convince the majority of the public to support it, because the majority of the public tends to be conformists. So a lot of them are interested in like establishing like aristocracy.
Mm-hmm. Naturally, people are going to ask who that aristocracy is going to be. Well, they an implied answer is themselves, but obviously people aren't going to be too interested in them, so they will have potential difficulties in getting mass appeal, unlike white nationalists or the alternative right or even the alternative left, which is one of Robert Lindsay's ideas, which I quite like quite a lot.
Well, I'll definitely get to that, but one thing that's fascinating is you're also into the into futurism and things like transhumanism. But to a lot of people, being a reactionary and a futurist might seem like contradictory. I know you have that. You have a photo on your Facebook page that shows Moscow. It's like a illustration. It's not a photograph, but it shows both the history and the older part of Moscow, and it also shows like a futuristic skyline. Is that just kind of for fun, or is that kind of sort of symbolic of both the sort of neo-reactionary views and futurist views?
Yeah, it's supposed to be symbolic. It's basically swords and spaceships. That's one way of putting it. It's a cover from a Russian sci-fi book, if you're interested. The cover art from a sci-fi book. But to expound further upon the topic, I think that neo-reactionaries and white nationalists and nationalists in general and alt-rightists and identitarians and I'll just call this whole sphere the alt-right from now on. Because I don't want to keep on going on about semantics. So the alt-right, I believe, would be well-served in adopting some transhumanist views because actually many of them rather align with their interests. So, one of the things that transhumanists are excited about is automation, for instance. With automation, there will basically be an incentive to create universal basic income. And universal basic income will largely serve the interests of the majority groups in European and European derived countries, because in contrast to welfare states, which predominantly send resources to various minority, so-called NAMs, non-Asian minorities, the universal basic income will be equally distributed. So in practical terms, it's going to benefit the majority group. Another thing that transhumanists like a lot is the idea of longevity and radical life extension. So one of the big problems that the alt-rightists and European identitarians are concerned with is the inundation of European societies with third world immigrants, with third world invaders, as they call them. This has been a big issue in the news, especially in recent weeks, as you're aware, in Germany and Sweden, all those refugees from Syria, or who say they're from Syria anyway, coming to Europe. And that raises fears of demographic replacement, of population replacement, of the camp of the saints. Now, one of the problems is that these immigrants have higher birth rates. So that's part of where the fear comes from. But another element to that is that they also have lower death rates because they tend to be much younger. Immigrants tend to be young people in their childbearing ages. If you pursue radical life extension, then this population replacement might not be so much canceled, but it will certainly be postponed. Because that will lower death rates, and that will especially lower death rates amongst the older people, who are predominantly European. like 90% plus European, whereas younger generations are 70% European and rapidly declining as the immigrants flow in. In general, I believe that pursuing consumerist technologies has the potential to reinforce rather than undermine identitarian interests. I understand that there's some concerns because a lot of people in the transhumanist movement, they're sort of postmodernist, they're sort of social justice warrior-ish to some extent. So I understand that nationalists might have hang-ups about associating with them. But the actual ideas, they are politically neutral and they are well worth embracing, I believe.
Well, the concept of being a reactionary just means opposing current change. You can point out that we're sort of headed in the wrong direction, but at the same time, you don't believe in like freezing, like the idealizing the past as perfect. You still believe? Do you believe in the concept of progress and that humanity should go forward and improve itself, as opposed to just being stuck in the past?
Well, I'm basically that's neo the action, and I think that so neo, yeah, I, at any instance, do like new things. I don't just want swords, I also want spaceships.
As far as culture and aesthetics go, do you have a preference for the sort of aesthetics of the past? Or do you believe that they can sort of coexist, like we can have both the old and new coexist side by side?
I certainly think that they should coexist. I mean, erasing the past is basically reminiscent of Bolshevism, of leftism. That's like the Bolsheviks who blew up old churches across Russia in the 1920s. And the Maoists who did the same in China during the Cultural Revolution. I'm not interested in that. Of course, I want to keep the cathedrals. The cathedrals, not the cathedral, but the cathedrals plural going. And castles and all the other great creations of European civilization and all of the civilizations, and they should organically coexist with advancing technology.
Is that happening in Moscow today? What are your thoughts on how that city has changed and how a lot of cities are changing? Do you see a city can become more futuristic and still preserve its past? So you basically believe that the two can coexist?
Well, I don't see any particular reason why they cannot. I mean, it's not like saturating an urban area with free Wi-Fi, for instance. So the Moscow Metro recently got free Wi-Fi across its entire domain. Why that should be problematic? I don't see it as problematic. That doesn't impact on the aesthetics, not that I can see anyway. In fact, in some ways, I could even see potential for improvement. So, for instance, when the automobile came in the 20th century, that negatively impacted cities in a very major way because roads had to be expanded, the narrow streets typical of medieval cities had to be widened, and so that involved knocking down old, nice old buildings. So that didn't do anything good for aesthetics, the coming of the automobile. But once you get these new technologies developed, so self-driving cars, and if they are married to Uber, companies like Uber, in which automobile ownership slips from people to being just another public good that's just traveling about. You'll need a lot fewer cars because they can be available. They can serve multiple people, and they can be maximized, and they can be optimized by algorithms to travel in a way that that doesn't cause that requires less space. And if anything, that would be a concrete example in which technology has the potential to actually reverse some of the aesthetic damage done by previous technological advances.
So I brought up the alternative left, which Robert Lindsay is proposing, and that's something that you're interested in, sort of the concept, but again, like, sometimes labels and semantics can be confusing, but just overall, what are your thoughts on that?
So basically, unlike Robert Lindsay, I'm not a communist. I think that central planning has been extremely inefficient at running economies. I'm not going to even go into the various ideological or moral aspects of it, but basically, experience has shown that communist societies, centrally planned societies, they are very economically inefficient. But the problem is, though, that so that's my disclaimer. However, there's also a way in which I support leftist ideas. So basically, just because I'm an alt-rightist, just because I identify with the alternative right, doesn't necessarily mean that I don't care about workers or that I want to suck up the oligarchs who are expanding their wealth thanks to the loosening of regulations and globalization and so on. I mean, just because I'm not a far leftist doesn't mean I want to become some kind of libertarian instead. So I can see that. So I can see where the alt left has potential, and what makes an alt left particularly needed, moreover, is because the current leftist structures, they have basically been hijacked by ideological partisans, the SJWs, the social justice warriors. Modern leftists, they care much more about things like gay pride parades than they do about making sure workers have a good salary.
One thing I was reading that's interesting about Russia, I think I read this on Robert Lindsay's blog, is he said there's a movement that's described as kind of liberals, and it kind of revolves, it's supported by Garry Kasparov, but they describe themselves as liberal, but they embrace both social liberalism, like they're strong supporters of like Pussy Riot and homosexual parades, but at the same time, they're in favor of neoliberal economics. What are your thoughts on that political strain within Russia?
Well, it's a political thing that thankfully has zero support, because that is not what leftism is about. Moreover, about Garry Kasparov specifically, I should mention that he is very highly anti-Russian. I mean, not just in the sense that he's against the current Putin government. I mean, that's normal. It's okay for people to have political differences. But he is actually actively against Russia. He has called for the West to introduce sanctions against Russia. That's naturally because of these antics. He has almost negligible support. His popularity approval rating is around 20%. Moreover, while he does engage in some leftist rhetoric while he's in Russia, because that kind of rhetoric sells there. I should point out that in the United States, where he spends a lot of his time, he's also a member of very libertarian and neocon institutions. So he's a regular op-ed writer for the Wall Street Journal. He's a member of the Cato Institute, I believe.
He was recently a major speaker at the, I live in Santa Barbara, so at the local university, UCSB, he recently gave a big speech here. He has more influence in the United States than in Russia, definitely.
That is certainly correct. And he's basically a ruthless cosmopolitan who flits between Russia and the United States, stirring up trouble in Russia, then, but having most of his audience in the West. So naturally and thankfully, he has nothing in the way of a constituency in Russia.
What are the main sort of political and ideological strains within Russia today?
I would say that there's approximately 60% of the population which can loosely be described as socially conservative and like to a reasonable extent, not like Taliban or anything, just as was normal in the 1970s and the 1960s in the West, who are generally patriotic and but otherwise politically apathetic. There's about 10% of the population that is highly liberal and pro-Western, and they tend to be quite a lot richer than the average population. There's about 20% or 25% of the population that is communist, so very leftist economically, but also but not leftist socially, as in socially liberal. And there's also 15 to 25% of the population that is actively nationalist. Those are the four main strains of ideological current in Russia today, I think.
Would you say that Putin sort of represents that majority group, the one you mentioned, that's more socially conservative? I know there's sort of a big debate going on. I know, like, some people say that Putin is a Russian nationalist, but I've also heard some Russian nationalists strongly dislike him.
That is very correct. Because although Putin is a Russian patriot, so he doesn't worship the West like the liberals do, for instance, whom the West supports. On the other hand, he is not ethnically conscious. So he is on record as saying that the Russian nationalist slogan, Russia for Russians, for instance, which appears during nationalist marches, is basically something only stupid people believe in.
So he's basically a civic nationalist.
A civic nationalist would be a very good way of putting it. So you're basically speaking of conservative, patriotic types in the United States, like Charles Murray, probably, the Heritage Foundation, those kinds of people, I think, if you move them to Russia.
What has Putin's economic policies been like? I know there was a lot of privatization and extreme income inequality under the Yeltsin administration.
So basically, it's a pretty paradoxical mix of leftism and rightism. On the one hand, under Putin, under the early Putin, there was introduced a flat rate income tax at 13% of incomes, which is basically a libertarian dream, and which is extremely rightist from an economic perspective. On the other hand, there have also been some more leftist policies, such as Russia remains a pretty protectionist place, all things considered. There is an industrial policy to provide protection to some sectors of the economy to make them, to help them develop until the point that they become internationally competitive. And that policy has in general been not without its measure of successes. So he is by no means a doctrinaire free marketeer either. So it's basically a an eclectic mix on both the left and the right that I would say the Putin regime has been pursuing.
Well, back to what we were touching on earlier, and also I mentioned, I did bring up the alternative left, I forgot the other one. I sent you that article about the radical center. Did you find that one fascinating?
Was that the one which was written by a Bay Area guy?
Yeah, that one.
I agreed with almost all of his points. But could you describe to the audience? Could you recapitulate his points? Well, both for the audience's benefit and for myself, because it's been a few days since I read that article.
Yeah, I actually commissioned him to write that article, but in an earlier show, we kind of talked about combining the best aspects of a Pat Buchanan and a Ralph Nader. But basically, it's mixing sort of the best ideas of the left and the right, and even some libertarian views, but at the same time being diametrically opposed to the American establishment. Basically sums it up.
So yeah, basically you don't want to invade the world, which is you don't want to invade the world, so the left is pretty good at that. Generally speaking, don't invite the world. That's what alt-rightists are best at. And look after your own people, especially your productive people, the workers. I think that's basically the foundation of any reasonable and sane society, pretty much.
So you have this post, the five types of Russian Americans. Do you mention which of these groups you identify with the most personally?
So the five types of Russian American, just to recap, is an article I wrote a few years ago, 3 years ago. It's not very politically incorrect, but a lot of people, including people who weren't very happy with it, maybe. They vouched for it, basically accuracy. And so those five types are white Russians who came here a long time ago. They're basically moderate conservative.
Would you say that group you mentioned, white Russians who were supporters of the Tsar, are they pretty much mostly totally assimilated by now?
Yeah. So, yeah, okay, well, out of those five groups, the so-called white Russians, the Soviet Jews, the egghead emigres, that's the academics who came in the 1990s because the Russian state stopped paying them their salaries, the Russian brides in the 1990s as well, and the Putin's expats who came here in the 2000s probably, many of them won't stay here forever, but some of them will. So between them, I'm basically a mix of egghead emigre. Well, my dad is a classic egghead emigre, an academic who emigrated, and I would basically be his son, but also have a measure of the Putin's expat in my makeup. So that's the answer to your question.
Oh, you said Putin expats. Oh, those are the people who arrived in the 2000s. So so Russian immigration, did it peak like in the late 80s and 90s? Has it sort of declined since then?
Yes, it has. It peaked in the 80s and early 90s because that's when a lot of ethnic minorities, especially the Jews and the Volga Germans, they emigrated. They emigrated from Russia to places like the U.S., Israel, Germany. Those are the big three. And also tons of academics emigrated. Mostly they emigrated to the United States and to Germany because, as I said, the 1990s Russia was basically virtually a bankrupt state, and in any case, the oligarchs who came to power during the 1990s, they couldn't care less about developing science or anything like that. So many academics, cognitive elite, camped out to the West during the 1990s. Since then, the decline has pretty much stopped because, well, firstly, all of those people who were ever going to leave in the first place had already left. and secondly because conditions in the city itself began to improve in 2000.
I know also Steve Saylor has written about this topic because where he lives in the San Fernando Valley of L.A., there's a large Soviet diaspora. But in the San Fernando Valley, I think the two big groups are Jewish and Armenian.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, the so-called Soviet Jews, they have adopted Russian culture, as in they speak Russian, but they are... in my experience, at least, they are very, very consciously Jewish. However, so they have their own jokes. One of those, I'm familiar with these people because I've met quite a few of them living here. So here's a classical joke. Ivan asks another Russian. Pyotr, what if we have to fight China? They have more than 1 billion people. And Pyotr replies, we'll win with quality over quantity, just like the Jews with the Arabs. But Ivan replies, but do we have enough Jews? So that's basically the classic Jewish question in the Bay Area. Classic example.
Is as large of a Russian community as L.A. or not as much?
Probably slightly bigger because that's the Silicon Valley and most of the immigrants here are Russian Jews who are somewhat quite a lot more intelligent and educated than average Russians or Americans. So they sort of congregate here.
And then the other group you talk about are the mail order brides.
Yes, about the mail order brides, that was a phenomenon that started up in the 1990s. Not all of them are from Russia. In fact, I dare say a majority of them are no longer from Russia. I think Ukraine and Moldova dominate that category of Russian brides nowadays. So basically, adventurous or women who want to emigrate to the United States or some other Western European country, one of the most reliable methods of doing that is to marry a husband due to their reputation of being like more traditional or whatever. That's not really the case, as quite a few of those husbands find out they divorce rate in Russia is actually on the global level second only after the United States. So a lot of the time it doesn't actually work out. But anyway, that's the story with them.
What do you see as the biggest misconception that Americans and Westerners have about Russia?
You know what? The blog which I used to write before I moved to UNS, one of the blogs I used to write was called The Russophile, and it had the subtitle of Exposing Western Myths About Russia. So there's a whole lot of them, and I find it difficult really to identify which of them is the biggest one. I can unravel them one by one. So there's different myths, for instance, that people have this way of exaggerating what is happening in Russia. So either it's very weak or it's very strong. So back in the 1920s, for instance, they were saying how Russia was the total morass and how it would never recover after the Bolshevik Revolution. And then in the 1930s, it started to everybody's surprise producing tanks and plastics and steel and coal in huge quantities and won World War II. And then they said that the Soviet Union was very strong. And then the Soviet Union collapsed. And then in the 1990s, they started... saying that Russia was the Soviet East, its population was declining, with no end in sight, and the Atlantic magazine put it, "The She Is Finished." That was from an article in 2000, and predicting that it would break up into small pieces in a few decades. Well, to the contrary, the Russian economy has recovered, and far from breaking up, Russia has instead expanded quite a bit with Crimea. So perhaps it's more of a psychological issue. Westerners tend to exaggerate Russia's prospects when it's rising high, and to diminish it, to doom monger, to prophesy its destruction when it's at a relative low point. But things don't work like that. They're a bit less extreme than the popular consensus would have at any one particular point in time.
You have this post, the Soviet parallels of the Fishtown's middle-aged white male mortality crisis. And Fishtown is this place, it's this working-class white community that Charles Murray has written about. But recently I saw this survey that said middle-aged white males without a college degree have the highest, I think, is it suicide rate or mortality rate or both?
The really strange thing about it is that U.S. white males, since the mid 1990s, the mortality rate has increased from 380 cases per 100,000 to 420 in 2013, whereas Hispanics and U.S. blacks, their mortality rate continues to decline. So U.S. blacks in the 50s still die at a higher rate than U.S. white males, but the gap is much, much smaller than it was 20 years ago. And what's really strange is that this pattern of rising mortality among middle-aged men, it's very unusual for first world countries. So the study's authors, Case and Deaton, they show that in Sweden, in Australia, in Canada, in Britain, in Germany, in France, middle-aged male mortality has basically halved, for the most part, in all those countries in the past 25 years, whereas in the United States it has risen quite a bit. And why that is the case, well, nobody knows, but it's pretty concerning that it's happening.
You don't come to a conclusion. You just put sort of the information out there.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I can speculate. So basically, like one of the ways in which the United States is unique is that basically agriculture is commercialized to a huge extent, and perhaps this might be causing agricultural companies to invest in calories over nutrients to a very large extent, which in turn causes people to overconsume. There's some evidence in this in increasing meal portions, and also the nutrient content of grains has been plummeting in the past 50 years, so you actually need to eat a lot more to get the same amount of nutrients as you did before, and that might be contributing to the obesity crisis. If you have an obesity crisis, then you have a lot of bodily pains, which you might want to take various opioids and painkillers to suppress that pain. But then it's difficult to overconsume them, and they're not really good for you in the first place. So this marriage of easily available painkillers and opioids made available by the commercialized pharmaceutical industry, together with the obesity, out of control obesity trends, there might be this kind of special combination of factors that might be contributing, that might be affecting white middle-aged Americans more than any other group.
I know you also you have a big focus on an interest in HBD. What in particular about HBD fascinates you?
So what fascinates me is not some pretty the mostly interesting but ultimately not very meaningful ideas such as that, such as the dominance of West Africans in sprint events and the dominance of East Africans in marathon events and all that kind of stuff. It's ironic that that is precisely the kind of stuff that is more or less free to discuss, because actually doesn't really have any big impact on world war on world issues apart from the Olympics thing. So why I'm concerned about, and I began writing about this way back, as in 2008, it's because I noticed that there seems to be a very close correlation between average IQ levels and as proxied by international student assessments such as PISA, and the levels of GDP per capita in countries. So
would you say that the exception to that rule would be like former communist countries as well as oil-rich Arab countries? I mean, a country like Kuwait or United Arab Emirates has a GDP much greater than their IQ.
Exactly, yes. And these are the exceptions that actually prove the rule, which I have been pointing out for a long time as well. It is precisely those countries which have been suppressed by inefficient central planning economic systems, which are performing far, far more badly than they should be. And it is those countries with so-called resource windfall, such as the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia and so on, who are performing substantially higher than they should be. Now, there's still some pretty unusual differences between the other countries. So, for instance, the United States is a bit richer than it should be according to its IQ levels, and I've explored that as well. But those are ultimately quite minor. Oil and communism basically explain 90% or so of the actual exceptions. And basically, since HBD teaches us that that personality traits are heritable and that intelligence is a personality trait, then it probably means that these differences are more or less fixed in stone. Well, I mean, you can obviously increase IQ by improving nutrition, for instance. That's still a pretty big issue in sub-Saharan Africa, and people should focus on that. And the fact that they're not, and that they're focusing on other things, I mean, basically, the idea being that actually denying HBD can actually lead to bad outcomes if that results to people tackling issues which are actually peripheral to development, such as say privatizing of water companies, like these neoliberal economists want developing countries to do, as if that will make any difference. Of course, it won't make any difference. It will just make some plutocrats richer, but it won't actually help out any ordinary people. So basically, it's important to acknowledge these truths, so that any interventions, any development interventions, can be more effective.
You have this post called "The Ethnic Politics of a Basic Income," and we touched on this earlier, how atomization will make a lot of jobs obsolete. So it will be necessary for that wealth to be generated towards some kind of basic income, instead of that wealth being taken up by the oligarchy. That wealth, if there is that massive atomization, there will have to be a basic income to compensate for that. But your poll shows that the more homogenous a country is, the more likely they are to be in favor of a basic income. At the very top is 69% in Finland, and then the United States, which is the least homogenous country, only 59% supports a basic income.
Well, I wouldn't say that's a very huge difference, on the other hand.
Yeah, it's only about 10% difference.
I mean it's a minor issue. I think that all else equal, more homogeneous societies will indeed basically with the current welfare systems, they are targeted towards poorer members of society.
So it has a dysgenic effect.
Yes. Whereas UBI, it's more evenly distributed. In fact, it's evenly distributed by definition. So I think that if anything, well, actually, if you think about it, maybe more heterogeneous societies will have fewer issues with universal basic income than they would with expanding the welfare state as it is currently construed.
So you've also been writing a lot about the conflict in Syria and Russia's recent role in Syria, how Russia is working with the Syrian government to fight against ISIS?
Yes. So basically, it's been recently revealed that the United States and some other NATO countries were planning to impose a no-fly zone over Syria, which in fact is...
I also heard that the United States and the Saudis are going to give anti-aircraft missiles to the rebels.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's basically a reaction and a pretty impotent one to a reality that has been made on the ground. So basically, they're not going to make any significant difference to the Russian air power because unless you have serious systems like books, like BUKs, then those sorts of lighter anti-aircraft stuff that they're going to be providing, they're not going to be a very major threat to the modern Russian fighters which are engaged there. So I don't see that particular thing as a very big issue.
What are your thoughts on the whole sort of origins of the conflict in Syria?
It's obviously an ethnic conflict to a very large extent. The Syrian regime, it has its base of support in the Alawite heartlands of the west of the country, the coastal regions and the areas around Damascus. The areas where the Islamist rebellions flared up, they are mostly Sunnis. And moreover, in one of my posts, I noticed that the higher the date of consanguineous marriage, or that is inbreeding in across Syrian territories, the more likely they were to be ruled by to host Islamist insurgencies. So that is also that factor. It's basically the coast versus the desert.
So it's basically kind of in a sense you're saying it's two different countries, one that's more advanced that supports Assad. Is there a difference in HBD? One thing I was looking at a blog, at a video, and it was showing a group of students in like Damascus, and I noticed a lot of them could basically like easily pass for Greek or Italian, and that's sort of a strong contrast to the photographs that you're seeing of all these refugees pouring into Europe. And first of all, a lot of those refugees are not even Syrian. A lot of them are from Eritrea, from Pakistan. But your point is that Syria is kind of like there's basically two different countries there.
I think that's a good way of putting it. It is two different countries, although the problem is that, much like in Ukraine, it is in fact actually a gradient of sorts. Although the Sunni versus Shiite division is a pretty good divisor, but you are completely correct. The far western provinces around Latakia and around Damascus, they are more progressive. I mean, as in the good sense, not the the good sense of progressive, so they don't wear hijabs. They are pretty secular. They don't persecute. They have good relations with Christians who also concentrated in the West, and the rate of inbreeding, consanguineous marriage, is only around 10-20%. Whereas once you go out to the eastern parts of Syria, you get this more rural and this more primitive society where the women are all covered up and the people are much more fundamentalist. They want to cut off the heads of the unbelievers, and so yeah, it's a difference that won't be readily reconciled, even if Assad were to triumph, and I don't know if it's worth trying to do that even.
What is the geopolitical role that Russia is playing in the Middle East? And do you see Russia as a significant geopolitical challenger to the power of both the United States and Saudi influence?
No, so basically, Russia has decided to come in and take the side of the Shiite bloc, Iran, Western Syria, and Lebanon. And if it works out, then that could tremendously increase its power in the region. Of course, I don't see it ever becoming, of course, dominant power, because if you look at the Russian intervention, it's pretty modest. It's basically 30 fighters, 4,000 troops, no more than 4,000 troops, maybe some special forces. But for the most part, those troops are just technicians who are going to be servicing the air force. It is going to be the Syrian Arab Army and the Hezbollah and the Iranians who will actually be doing the fighting on the ground. Russians won't be fighting them, apart from maybe a few special forces. But overall, the United States has got dozens of bases around the region. It's got hundreds of fighters. Fighter planes in the region, so I don't see Russian influence as eclipsing the United States. What I see it as is basically a way of checking unimpeded spread of Saudi influence and Sunni influence across the region, which is substantially tied to the United States. There was a report in the Financial Times a few weeks ago, which stated that the Russian response of moving in military forces to Syria was a very ad hoc affair, done on short notice, and it was done on intelligence support that the U.S. and its allies planned to impose a no-fly zone over Syria, which would in fact just have translated to explicit support for the rebels and Islamists against Assad.
As for the whole sort of migrant crisis, you said you didn't really want to get into it too much, since like it's a very, very important issue. But basically, you said that it's everything that's been said about it has pretty much been discussed by the alternative right. That you don't really have that much more to say about it.
Well, yeah, pretty much. I mean, the one thing I would add is that there might also be a very political element to it, as in all these migrants come in, and it will just be a further excuse to conduct even more invasions and imperialism in the Middle East, to like pretend you're solving the problem, while in fact actually further reinforcing it, and there might be concrete people who are very interested in that kind of outcome. But otherwise, I pretty much agree with everything that people like Steve Taylor, for instance, have written about it, and nothing more need be added.
Yeah, I mean, there's two aspects of it. One of it is that the foreign policy put forth by the United States and its allies is creating the crisis. But on top of that, you also have a lot of people coming in who are basically just economic migrants. But it's basically people like Steve Saylor who have been warning about like this invade the world, invite the world policies have really been vindicated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and basically, what the only thing I would add is that those self-enforce each other. They enforce themselves. I don't think Steve Saylor has been as explicit about that as he might have been. And there might be concrete elite interests or even conspiracies who are constantly interested in these types of outcomes.
One thing you did write a recent post about Germany called Dysgenic Deutschland. Is that
mm-hmm.
about... that's not necessarily about immigration. Are you talking about immigration, or you're talking about among Germans themselves?
Well, I mean, you can check out the academic psychometrics paper on which it is based on yourself. I mean, the finding they have found is pretty minimal. It's that spatial IQ in Germany seems to have peaked around the mid 1990s. And has since been in accelerating decline. And I think that's pretty much plausible. If you look at PISA results, for instance, PISA International Index Test, you'll see that Germany has been declining as well. In fact, Poland overtook it in the last series of tests in 2012. So obviously, like if you have more immigrants from 80s IQ type countries, then yeah, obviously, and since they're younger as well, they'll have a bigger impact on the lower age groups, and you'll see faster declines associated with that in these kinds of tests. But also there might also be a concrete dysgenic element to it all as well, of course, because it's pretty well known that across pretty much the entire developed world that dumber women have fewer children than more intelligent women. That's pretty well known, and solving it is a big issue, and it's really difficult to solve short of adopting some transhumanist solutions, actually.
And with transhumanism, you've been very involved with the transhumanist movement. I know you spoke at one of their major events they had. I think it was in the Bay Area.
Yeah, I sometimes speak at these events. That's correct.
Is it all just sort of hypothetical, or do you have like concrete ideas, scientific ideas out there of implementing transhumanism?
So the three technologies that I'm not going to talk about really speculative stuff like technological singularities or anything like that, or building a superintelligence, like discussed in Nicholas Bostrom's recent book on superintelligence. What I'm going to be talking about is the issues which I think are pretty important and which are just about on the horizon. Those are augmenting intelligence, automation, and radical life extension. So augmenting intelligence, basically there's been some new techniques developed, CRISPR-Cas9, which allows you to actually alter the human genome. And there's some very big projects right now centered especially by the Beijing Genomics Institute to identify the genes which are responsible for human intelligence. So if you could combine these two, and you could potentially be able to correct genetic spelling errors, as some people call it, and to radically increase the IQ of your babies, that should become technologically possible, according to people who are more or less in the know, as who I've talked to, in about a decade's time. Of course, there'll be many social barriers to acceptance, and some countries will ban it, so only the oligarchs can do it, and other countries will instead see it as a major competitive advantage and maybe really encourage it. So you could get a whole new vector of by which global inequality will increase, because as we know from HBD and intelligence theory that GDP per capita and economic vitality depend on a great deal on the average IQ levels. So that's one aspect. The other aspect is automation, which I've talked about, and which will probably start coming online in a really big way once advanced AI is married to robotics in the 2030s, maybe. And radical life extension is more speculative, much more speculative, but it's not impossible that there could be major breakthroughs on that front as early as the mid-century.
And with radical life extension, obviously, it's important if people are they preserving youth and health, or are they going to radically extend their lives and like be in old age for like another 50 years? Because that doesn't sound like a lot of fun.
No, it doesn't. Well, actually, it's explicitly about rejuvenation, that is, preserving health. And actually, if you think about it, they're inextricably bound together, but because ultimately, what is a key component of old age? It's vastly increased risk profiles for all sorts of diseases, which lead to mortality. However, by definition, radical life extension will suppress mortality. So, and one of the necessary prerequisites for that is to rejuvenate people, because they are actually sort of closely linked.
Anatoly Karlin, it's been a really great show, so I'd like to thank you for being on.
Okay, thank you.
That's all we have for today's show, so take care, and we'll be back with you next time.
Okay, that's been a pleasure as well. Love it, Doug. Okay, have a nice night.